Good day, everybody. Please have a seat. Welcome to Dr. Hugh Ross's Paradoxes Sunday School class. A few notes. Dr. Ross is not here today. We have a special guest. I'll introduce him in a moment. Dr. Ross will be back on April 13th. Do not come next week. It's Easter, and there's no class. Okay. No class on Sunday next week. Is it 2 weeks?
Easter's in 2 weeks. Next week is Palm Sunday.
Palm Sunday. Yeah. Uh-oh, my schedule's wrong then. I'll have to get back to everybody on that one.
what's a week among friends?
Yeah, RTB told me next week they were not going to be available. So, anyway... Dr. Ross will be back on April 27th and May 4th. Ross Hoagland is May 11th. And today, our presenter is Dave Sargent, longtime class member. He's been part of Paradoxes longer than anybody other than Hugh Ross. 42. And Dave's going to be talking today on evolution, why I do not believe in it anymore. So Dave was an engineer. He's retired now, correct, Dave? And he worked at JPL, worked on the Viking mission and on the Voyager missions. So he's had a lot of experience there. And with that, let's say a prayer and we'll get him up here. Heavenly Father, we just ask your blessings on Dr. Ross and his work and mission today, wherever he's at. We ask you to bless Dave Sargent's presentation. Tune our minds and hearts to his message that we may be more effective in our witnessing endeavors. We ask this in Jesus' name, amen. And I'll get back to you on that schedule in a minute. Thank you.
Is your microphone on? Good morning. I titled this, Why I No Longer Believe in Evolution Anymore. I went to college, and in college, the way I was able to get my job at JPL against the other people I competed is I love the sciences, and so I had taken biology classes, geology classes, archaeology classes, electronics, which turned out to be my actual profession, television production. So I took lots of variety of classes, science, physics, chemistry. I took all those classes because I actually just loved them, obviously. And it turned out taking those classes worked out very good because to get a job at JPL is very difficult. And when they looked at all the classes I took and that I got A's in all those classes, I got the job to work at JPL working on the Viking, which was the first lander to land on Mars. And of course, that entailed geology, archaeology, biology. I did a biology test, and so I worked there. I have to appreciate my biology teachers, both in high school and college, because when they taught evolution, they clearly stated, they said, the fossil record doesn't support evolution, this evolutionary tree that we present, like what's on the screen there. But they assured me and said, within the next 10 years, as we dig up more fossils, we'll see all these transitional forms that are missing. And that was their prediction, and I appreciated the fact that they were honest. And so I can tell you now it's been more than 10, 20, 30 years, and their prediction did not come true. The fossil record is full of what biologists call paradoxes, right? Paradoxes that they can't solve. And we're going to talk about those paradoxes. So I'm going to present the evidence for evolution and the many problems that evolution has. The definition of evolution. Evolution, actually, when we say that, most people think of biological evolution. What they're really referring to is macroevolution, with one species coming to another. But the word evolution just strictly means change over time. So the universe has evolved. Doesn't mean, if you believe that, doesn't mean you believe in biological evolution. Societies have evolved. And of course, life has evolved and changed. I monitor the chat. We have lots of people that are watching online, and if you're online, I'm glad that you're here. And I also know that a number of people on the online chat believe in a young earth, and I appreciate that our brothers and sisters in Christ are here watching online and watching this Paradox class. I'm going to talk about millions of years because, and billions of years, because the earth is 4.5 billion years old. We usually round it up to 4.6. Young earthers claim that the Bible teaches a young earth, which means the earth is 5 to 10,000 years. In reality, if you look at the whole Bible, not just the first book or the first five books, obviously, so all the answers are not in Genesis. We have to use all 66 books of the Bible. And I have all these verses up here that teach the earth is not only old, but it teaches the earth is ancient. The Bible uses the word ancient to describe the earth directly, two times. And so the Bible does not teach young earth at all. A lot of young earth creationists claim that the laws of physics changed when Adam and Eve sinned. The Bible, on the other hand, has two verses in the Bible, actually more than these two, that emphatically say that the laws of earth are fixed and do not change. Young earthers claim that when Adam and Eve sinned, that caused death to plants and animals. And again, they quote just the Old Testament to do that, but we have to look at the New Testament too. And the New Testament four times declares, that death is not evil, death is not bad, it's part of life, and that sin brought death to mankind. It clearly says here, to all mankind. And Romans specifies that, obviously, that we can't talk about plants and animals. And so somehow, obviously, the death of plants and animals, young earth, then equate even to the salvation. They make it a salvation issue. And I can tell you, obviously, when you get into heaven, God is not going to ask you how old the earth is. It's not a salvation issue. They're going to ask, do you have a personal relationship with Jesus Christ? The Romans 21 says that Jesus knocks on every single heart. And if a person opens the door and lets Jesus into their heart, that's how you get into heaven. Nothing else, right? Apostle Paul teaches, I teach Jesus Christ and him crucified, period, right? Resources. I'm going to talk a lot of issues, and I can't go into depth on all of them. It's quite interesting. I taught this class 10 years ago, and I have twice as much information as I did 10 years ago. So biology is one of these things, or evolution, obviously, macroevolution is one of these things where every year you have less evidence, not more. So I have lots of resources up here looking at the issue of evolution, and reasonstobelieve.org has lots of information also. So when we talk about evolution, most people then we're talking about Darwinian evolution, the theory of that. And so Charles Darwin came up with the idea at the Galapagos Islands that organisms change over time through natural selection, small inherent variations, and over time as they reproduce. In reality, when we say evolution, when I talk to somebody about evolution, I have to say, what kind of evolution are you talking about? So there is a microevolution, that is real. We can see that in real time. The classic examples of that is Darwin's finches, bacteria, and the spotted moth. And those are the three that evolutionists will always bring up, and we're gonna look at each one of those. Next one we talk about is evolution is microbial, and that's dealing with bacteria. And so people that believe in evolution will point to this bacteria changing over time, in particular being drug resistant and being able to change what kind of food they feed on as proof of evolution. But that's only works at the micro level because of the huge population. Next one, a lot of times biologists will talk about speciation, and Hughes talked about that, is when you say that, you have to ask about what's the definition of a species. Hughes talked about in biology, he has counted up to 17 definitions of speciation. Like some people will claim that a teacup poodle and a Great Dane are two different species. And other biologists will say, no, they're both dogs. And so who do you believe, right? When we say evolution, most people are talking about macroevolution, the tree of life, claiming obviously that we went from a single bacteria to humans, in 3.8 billion years, right? Huge changes. The one I have really difficult to time with is they claim that a wolf playing in the sea shifted into a whale, right? And they'll give you a picture of this little wolf and claim that this wolf has something related to a whale and this whale splashing at the beach, you know, had its nose turned to its head, its legs disappear, and then just a few million years, it's swimming in the ocean. Very difficult time believing that. And then the last one is chemical evolution. And so we have a whole book on that one, Origins of Life. Even secular scientists say that this is the best book on the origins of life. And the reason is that most biologists only look at biology when they're talking about the origin of life, whereas Reasons to Believe integrates all the sciences. So they look at biology, geology, astronomy, just the evolution of the sun, the earth, and that's all included in this book. And so even secular scientists reviewing this book said this is actually the best book that covers the origins of life. All right, so looking at the origins of life, every year, Hugh and Fuzz Rana, with Reasons to Believe, they pictures on the back of the book, they go to Origin of Life conferences when they occur every few years. And they say it's the only conference they go to where at the end of the conference, everybody is more depressed than they were when they stepped in. And that's because the origins of life, instead of having more evidence every year, has less evidence every year. So last time I taught this, I only had about 3 points, and now I have a whole bunch. We know that there was no primordial soup. So the claim was there was some like tide pools that had just the right chemicals in it, and they had a billion years, and life came out of this primordial soup that was all full of just the right stuff. We know now, obviously, there was no soup. The claim was that it would take at least about a billion years for life to evolve in that soup. We know now, as soon as the Earth cools, we have life, right? There is no time. There's no billion years for this to develop. The next claim was obviously is that the first life forms are going to be very, very simple, you know, much more simple than the current life. We know now that the first life form, cyanobacteria, also known as blue-green algae, is very complex. Sometimes they'll claim that the first life forms formed in underwater sea vents, right, since there's no primary soup. Well, I got news, those extremophiles, they're more complex than cyanobacteria. Because extremophiles have to have a very robust genome to be able to survive in that very harsh environment. And so we know that these steam vents can't be the origins of life. We have the oxygen antioxidant paradox has not been solved. UV oxygen paradox has not been solved. Homochirality, all life uses left-hand amino acids, but in nature, you find left and right equally mixed. And so that has not been resolved. And the other one, obviously, is that proteins are very complex. And if you look at three-dimensional models, these proteins have to fold very specifically in order to come together. And so the first life forms would have to have these proteins folded together. And the DNA has the design for that and how that folding would happen naturally in nature just isn't there. So and there's more than problems than this, but this is just the first one, easiest ones to talk about. So when people say, I believe in evolution because there's overwhelming proof or evidence, one of the first things that they're going to talk about is they're going to talk about Darwin's finches, how the beak size changes with food over time. What they don't tell you, obviously, is these changes, you don't get to keep it. If the seeds became bigger and harder, the finches' beaks would become bigger. What they don't tell you, you know, is guess what? When the seeds get small again, what happens to the beaks? Do they stay big? No, they go back to being soggy. And so it's a sine wave. You do not get to keep any change you have, right? So anybody tells me about these finches, I obviously tell them, you know, what happens when the seeds get small? And not one would say, oh, the beaks get smaller, because they all think that you get to keep the change that you benefit, and you don't. They'll point to the peppered moth. So we had this pepper moth. There was pollution, and the trees turned black, and so natural selection drove the moth to be black. And that's a real evolution. But guess what? If you clean all the trees, what do you think the pepper moth's going to do? It's going to go back to being peppered, right? You don't get to keep the change that you get. This is the number one proof that evolutionists will say. When I talk to somebody that believes in evolution, they will point to this as absolute proof that evolution is true. I have a very difficult time keeping a straight face because they sound like children. A looks like B, you know, and so B must have come from A, right? And then I'll ask them, well, how? And then they'll always say, well, natural selection, evolution. So then we go talk about natural selection evolution to see, well, those two mechanisms produce this. And the answer, of course, is no. You know, and so they just believe that natural selection works. They just believe that that mutations work, and they have nothing about it, right? So just because A looks like B doesn't mean that A came from you. You have to explain how, why. As somebody who believes in design, I ask them and say, why do most vehicles have four wheels? And the answer is because that's the most efficient and stable. Two wheels works. Is it stable? No. Three wheels works. Is it stable? No. We don't have more three-wheel vehicles because it's not stable. Most vehicles on the road, 99.8% of them, you know, are going to have four wheels because you get stability and you also get economy. You could have six wheels, but now you're going to have a decrease in gas, fuel, and an increase in weight. And the more wheels you add, you know, the less fuel efficiency you get. And so most cars have four wheels. So why do most life forms have four limbs? Because it is the most efficient design, right? We have life with three legs, but it's restricted to insects, right? We have things with eight legs. They're restricted to spiders and octopuses, you know? So four is a great design. So the mere fact that A looks like B is childish. You have to ask why. Again, this is another one that will bring brought out about why I believe in people believe in evolution. They'll say, we have bacteria. This bacteria has become resistant to antibiotic, particularly penicillin. What they don't tell you is, if you take away penicillin and you let that bacteria live for about 10 years, in 10 years, that bacteria will no longer be resistant to antibiotics. Again, you can make life forms change, but you do not get to keep the change. As soon as the external pressure is removed, the animal wants to go back to normal. And evolutionists, the people who believe in evolution, just don't ignore that fact. If they know it, they suppress it, and a lot of them are just ignorant and just don't know that. You do not get to keep change. Any change a species makes, if you take away the external pressure, that animal will go back to its original. DNA, it does not want to change. You can force it to change, but you do not get to keep the change. Very important point. Macroevolution. So this is what obviously most people believe, obviously. If you go to college, you know, they're going to show you this tree of life. And they're going to tell you, obviously, that these are very, very simple life form, a single-cell bacteria, you know, all evolved into this big tree of life. The problem, obviously, once again, is the fossil record doesn't support this. Natural selection doesn't prove this, and mutations don't prove this. There is just no evidence for this, right? And the claim, again, was obviously that as we find more fossils, we will see all these transitional fossils gradually appearing, and that claim just isn't true. And that's why science works. You make a prediction, and then you see if that prediction is going to be true. So the prediction was that as they dig up more fossils, we would find all these transitional forms in between that will prove this tree to be correct. And that claim has turned out to be false. Every year we find out more fossils, and what we find is that life forms appear, they remain unchanged, and they disappear. No change over that time period. No change. So the claim is obviously what makes life forms change. So we have natural selection. Natural selection works, but as I described, it has limits. Mutations can change things, has extreme limitations. Genetic drift can change. We'll talk a little bit about that. Epigenetics, this is something that's new, wasn't there 10 years ago. The Bible says that the sins of the father will be passed down through the generations. Turns out scientists now know that's proved. Your human behavior will change the DNA of your children, right? And so if you eat healthy, exercise, don't do drugs, don't do alcohol, your children are more likely to be healthy. If you're somebody that's involved in drugs, alcohol, you know, sin, you know, a poor lifestyle, smoking, drinking, whatever it is, your children are more likely to be unhealthy. Absolutely proved. And so your behavior will change your gene. The next one, just in bacteria. Bacteria can have gene exchange. But again, we're not talking about bacteria here. We're talking about evolution. So natural selection. Natural selection is where in a population, if an animal has a beneficial adaptation or mutation, obviously, that will get passed down to their children, and those children will have more survivability. So on the surface, that sounds correct. But we have to dig down a little deeper and find out the full definition of natural selection, not just this big overall branch. Because if I say that, that's correct, right? 10 years ago, I used an analogy, and people didn't like it, obviously, that if Hitler decided to kill every redheaded person on the planet, you know, there'd be no more redheaded people, right? That's natural selection, period, you know? So it was a little chart, obviously. So the species that have X's in them, they didn't have an adaptation to change over time. The descendants that had something that was better, survived. But natural selection cannot make things like lungs, you know, eyes and hearts. You know, it just can't do that. So it can change things, but there's limitations, and we're going to talk about those limitations. We've actually got real-time tests over thousands of years to prove if evolution is correct. So for about 13 to 33,000 years, we've been breeding dogs. And so just as we talked about, obviously the claim was that a whale comes from a wolf, right? So somehow you made this wolf larger to become a whale. So we have taken a dog, in this particular case a wolf, that in the wild has a very long lifespan, you know, like some 13 to 20 years. And we bred that wolf, and the DNA of canines is such that you can change it quite a bit. And so we have bred this wolf all the way to be a Great Dane I have up here. I've seen these Great Danes on their hind legs are taller than me. And we've also bred them to be as small as a teacup poodle that will hold in your hand. And what we have found is when you take an animal and you change it from its natural size, that animal becomes very sickly. So anybody that has a large dog, you know, like a Great Dane, you take the lifespan from 20 years to 8 years. And that animal's going to have arthritis. It's going to have, you know, joint pains. It's not going to live as long. It's going to be very expensive to have a Great Dane. It's a very sickly animal. Or likewise, obviously, if you take that wolf and you breed it down to the size of a teacup poodle, you know, the little teacup poodle only lives 3 years, right? 3 years. And in evolution, they claim that obviously that species that have increased in size, like to go to a whale or a giraffe or an elephant, you know, and they've claimed that species have also gone up and then gone down in size. Well, I got news, obviously. If you take a wolf and you breed it up to a whale, that whale should probably only live, you know, 3, 4, 5 years. And yet we have whales that live 200 years. The breeding of dogs just does that. A lot of times people tell me, say, well, this is in nature. This isn't in the wild. And I ask them, well, what's the difference? What's the difference between breeding a wolf to be a Great Dane, making it larger, and having a whale go from a wolf to a dog or an elephant coming from, you know, something the size of a goat? There is no difference. It's increase in size. It doesn't matter whether it's bred or whether it's in the wild. It's the same process. If you were to put all these animals in the wild, guess what? The teacup poodles would all go away, the Great Danes would all go away because they're not hunters, and everything would go back to the size of a wolf. You do not get to keep the change that you find, period. We've done the same thing. Oh, it's the same thing. I just talked about all this. The animals become weaker, less survivability. They have all these lifespan problems. Very unhealthy when you start breeding animals away from their original DNA selection. Dogs, like I said, have great diversity. On the other side, you look at chimpanzees, and you could do breeding for chimpanzees for 1 million years, and they wouldn't change at all. Chimpanzees have the least amount of DNA variability. So one chimpanzee will look a lot like the other chimpanzee, and no matter how much natural selection you did on this and trying to find the biggest chimpanzee and breed it with another big chimpanzee, their children are going to look just like a regular chimpanzee. Because they have the least amount of DNA variance. So there's just some animals you can't change at all, period. You cannot change the chimp. You know, the DNA is just not there to do it. We've been breeding horses for 6,000 years, and it's absolutely amazing. We've taken a standard horse that lives 28 years. We bred them up to draft horses, twice the size of a regular one. Their lifespan goes to 18 years. Ponies actually don't drop as much. They go, you know, 28 to 25 years old. But the problem, obviously, is the pony horse now has poor hoofs, lameness, high levels of blood flat, and are just very unhealthy. Draft horses, we double the size of a horse. Oh, my gosh, the cost is just incredible. You actually have some draft horses where their skin literally just rots and falls off their body. Life doesn't like to change. The DNA coding has error correction in it, and it says, I do not want to change. If you make me change, I am not going to be healthy. You do not get to keep the change that you make. So natural selection works, but has severe limitations. Again, species don't like change. Can you change an animal's color? Yes. Can you change its size a little bit? Yes. Can you change its personality, domesticate it? Absolutely. You know, can you increase the body size? Yes, but it will drive the animal extinct. Mutations is the next one. Everybody will say mutations, obviously, is the next part of changing things. So natural selection makes things, animal species change. It does, but you don't get to keep the change. The other claim is that mutations, obviously, beneficial mutations in particular, is what produced eyes, lungs, new muscles, and things like that. And so there are mutations. Mutations are just errors in the DNA coding process, and there are several types, way that that happens. So those mutations get carried on from one generation to another, right? There are three types of mutations. There's neutral ones. Now that we have we have more people going through these whole body scans, right? You can pay whatever, you know, $500-$600 and have your body scanned from head to toe. We found out that there are more neutral mutations in the human population than we thought. There's lots of people walking around with only one kidney. There's people walking around with three kidneys and don't even know it, right? Because if they haven't done the body scan or x-ray, they don't know that. So we found out that there's lots and lots of neutral mutations. And because of these full body scans and more people going to doctors and having x-rays and MRIs, we found out that there's lots of neutral mutations. On the flip side, obviously, most of the mutations, a lot of the mutations, are harmful. They call them deleterious. That has been increasing. There's lots of mutations in the DNA that are very harmful. Beneficial mutations are very, very, very rare and very unhelpful. I spent hours and hours on the internet trying to find beneficial mutations for humans, and we're going to look at that, right? So we now have millions and millions of people going to thousands and thousands of doctors. So we have every year we have a bigger database to see if there's beneficial mutations, right? And with a huge population size, in theory, evolution says we should start seeing some positive mutations. Animals that are larger have more harmful mutations, and they drive them extinct. So for bacteria, mutations is great for them, right? You know, because they become resistant to bacteria, things like that. But when you get into larger animals, our size, whales, elephants, the mutations do not benefit that animal. It drives it towards extinction. Over 98% of animals that ever lived on this planet are extinct. And why? Because natural selection and mutations drove them extinct. It did not change them, it drove them extinct. And so 98% of everything that ever lived is dead. Neutral mutations, classic. I already talked about that, having three or one kidneys. I love these cats, obviously, that have one green eye and one, you know, yellow eye. That's one. Extra digits. There are actually people with six fingers. There's cats. It's a very common mutation for cats to have six fingers on their paw instead of five. Cats being born with no tail or short tail, that's a mutation. So there's lots and lots of neutral mutations, and I could go on and on. We don't have time. Harmful ones. We just talked about this. This is incredible. When I did this class 10 years ago, they only had 800 harmful mutations to humans. In the last 10 years, that list now has gone to 2,000. So in the last 10 years, we have found 1,200 more harmful mutations in the human body, right? Why? Because we have more people going to more doctors, right? You know, and in the United States, developing countries have more mutations. This is just a partial list, obviously. So these mutations, obviously, what do? They drive things extinct. It doesn't benefit them. The only thing it benefits is if your population is over like a quadrillion. So for bacteria, maybe termites, maybe ants are in that category. Mutations are beneficial. For anything bigger than an ant or a termite, the mutations drive that animal extinct. And we have no evidence, obviously, of a mutation designing an eye, a lung, a heart, new muscles. That's what they claim, but there's just no evidence for that. The evidence shows that mutations drive animals extinct. In humans, what do we have? The beneficial mutations that we have found, there are some Jews that are immune to HIV, so that's a beneficial mutation. There's one family in Connecticut with very strong bones. That would have been great in the Middle Ages, but it doesn't do them much benefit now. There's a very rare mutation in a few families where they'll have increased muscle size and very low fat. For the overall population, eyesight is increased, obviously. Hugh crowds that up to, obviously, if you were in the Middle Ages and had poor eyesight, your odds of surviving the battle would be pretty poor, you know, or if a cart's coming down a mountain for you, obviously, and you can't see it coming. So eyesight's got better. Because of mutations and diet, the human population has got a little bit taller, and there are some people that can't digest milk, that are able to digest milk, I'm sorry. So those are about it I can find for beneficial mutations. There are some other ones that people claim are beneficial, but then when you read it, it's not there. The claim is that there's some people that are immune to malaria. That's a lie. They get malaria, they just don't get as sick, right? And so when you read the literature, you have to really dig into it, because unfortunately there is bias. There's lots of these beneficial mutations that they claim is beneficial, and then when you read the literature, the final conclusion is it's not true. It's just not true. Very sad. So other than bacteria, maybe termites and ants, mutations drive things extinct, and they do not create new lungs, you know, organs. The evidence is just not there. So that's a very false claim. Examples of that. So the African elephant has 60,000 muscles in its trunk, can pull up a tree or pick up a dime. And the claim, obviously, is that there were 60,000 random mutations that designed this trunk in just a few million years. That's just not there. The claim is obviously that there are transitional fossils in there. You will find lots of documentaries on elephants and woolly mammoths. I could not find one documentation for this animal. So this is the animal they claim is the transitional fossil for an elephant. And if you look at its jaw, and it's called the shovel mouth elephant, it's just ridiculous. You will not find one documentation on this animal. Why? Because it doesn't fit in the evolutionary tree, right? You know, so all of a sudden this animal developed this funny jaw, and then all of a sudden that funny jaw went away and the trunk got longer. It's just ridiculous. And yes, where an elephant come from? And they'll say it came from a manatee or it came from a little teeny rodent. The claims are just unreal. And so we won't find documentaries on this because it's just too ridiculous. There'll be plenty on elephants, be plenty on woolly mammoths, but you won't find one on these things. So the prediction was the fossil record that you're going to have this tree, and you're going to have all these transitional species that will fill in this tree to show that species just continuously changed. But as we dug up these fossils over the last 50 years, instead what we have found, obviously, is B and C. We show that species appear, they remain unchanged for millions of years, and then they go extinct, all these dead ends. And then when they claim they find a transitional fossil, we'll find out it is not true, right? So species appear and they disappear. The bottom one, obviously, is the Cambrian explosion. In the Cambrian explosion, exactly all at the same time, every single body plan appeared. No evolution at all. You know, all these body plans appear. So even just the Cambrian explosion proves that evolution is not true. So there's a lack of transitional fossils. The tree just does not support evolution. This is a bird that they claim was a transition between dinosaurs and birds, and they even call birds dinosaurs now. And so it dates back 150 million years ago, and this was claimed, oh, evolution is true. They call this animal the ancient bird. The reason for this is because it has teeth and it had a tail. And so they claim that was absolute proof that it's a cross between a dinosaur and a bird. And so it looked that way for a while because this was found, obviously, over 100 years ago. Problem is in China in 1998, they found basically a crow with a special tail. They found a fish in its stomach and plant material, fully feathered, no tail, no teeth, and it lived at exactly the same time as the ancient bird. And so they call this, obviously, once again, a temporal paradox, right? Where now you have the more advanced animal living at the same time or before the transitional form, and that's very common. And so this bird just totally knocked it out. Incredibly, they went ahead and called birds dinosaurs, even though this came out, right? Just ignoring it. They ignored this one also. You'll find very few articles on this because it doesn't fit the paradigm. We found a 110-million-year-old footprint of a modern bird. Again, that crow-type species. Large brain, very intelligent, appearing really early, almost the same time that dinosaurs appear. And so my prediction, obviously, is that birds are going to be, or you're going to find that modern birds came at the same time as dinosaurs. There's absolutely no way that a dinosaur evolved into a bird because the bird is there at the beginning of the fossil record, right? You know? The evidence for birds not being dinosaurs is so great that there's a large section of scientists, secular scientists, who've got together and call themselves banned dinosaurs. Birds are not dinosaurs, because the people that are making this claim about birds being dinosaur are just ignoring the evidence. Does the Bible allow for evolution? And that all depends on this one word, obviously. It says God created every animal after its own kind. The Hebrew word for kind there is men, and it's a very broad definition. So it could be interpreted as that God created, say, one feline cat, and all cats came from that, would fit in the Bible. You could say that there was one canine produced, and all the canine came from that. Or you could interpret this as being, you know, individual species, right? That God created one type of tiger and one type of lion. You could interpret it that way. So the Bible obviously does allow for some evolution to occur because of this definition. And so microevolution, has no problem with the Bible. Another problem with evolution is we have had these lots of very mass extinction events where 95% of the species went extinct, and immediately within, you know, some cases anywhere from 10,000 to a million years, you have a complete ecosystem, including large animals. And evolution just doesn't change that fast. It can't produce these new animals this quickly. The first one was the Avalon explosion. We went from single-cell animals, and then bang, at this year, 575 million years ago, you all of a sudden have large animals, large creatures, multicellular animals. So a lot of people know about the Cambrian explosion, but there's actually two explosions. The first one was the Avalon. These went extinct, and then you had the Cambrian explosion. And we have an exact year from that now. It used to be, they used to say, it was millions of years that these animals appeared, and that's just not true. That's old information. The science books have a really hard time updating with brand new information. I found it where they're quoting stuff, 20 years old and ignoring brand new evidence. So 542 million years ago exactly, right, plus or minus a couple of years, all of a sudden every body plant appears and the Cambrian explosion. Evolution cannot do this, right? Every single body plant that's on the planet right now appeared at the Cambrian explosion. No evolution at all. We have massive extinction. So this one, 95% of all the species on life disappeared, and immediately after that, you have complete ecosystems, including large dinosaurs. Evolution just can't do that in that short period of time. We have another extinction event, 201 million years ago. All the Jurassic dinosaurs go extinct. Kids all learn about Jurassic dinosaurs, and within just a few thousand years, you have a whole new set of dinosaurs, right? Huge animals. In a very short period of time, all the old dinosaurs are gone, all the new dinosaurs are there. Evolution cannot explain how Earth recovered that quickly. I talked about animals appear in the fossil record and they remain unchanged, right? And we have some animals that survive these extinction events. So the horseshoe crab been around 450 million years, no change at all. Elephant sharks, 420 million years, absolutely no change. The nautilus, no change in 500 million years. And so whether it's alive or whether it's dead, it appears in this fossil record, it remains, it goes extinct. No evolution, no change. We talk about these mass extinction events, and the Bible actually tells us that's normal. It is the property of life to go dead. The Bible claims that, obviously. And God renews the face of the earth. So these mass extinction events and these mass speciation events, the Bible tells us that we should find that in the fossil record. So Psalm 100 directly talks about these mass extinction events and talks about the mass recovery in the book of Psalms. There's a lot of Ice Age animals that people just don't talk about again because they just don't fit in the evolutionary tree. I put a couple at the bottom there. Another reason, obviously, that evolution has a serious problem is if we look at convergent evolution. In real-time experience, we found out that evolution does not repeat. So they took bacteria and forced it to feed on a different type of food. If you take away that food, it goes back. It tells you don't get to keep that change. But then they reran the experiment again and again to see if it would repeat. And guess what? Does evolution repeat? And the answer is no. And yet biologists claim that not only does evolution repeat, it repeats in totally separate, unrelated animals, which is just totally absurd. So the first one to look at is marsupials. Other than the Virginia possum, all marsupials live in Australia. And yet in Australia, these marsupials are all found in Australia except for the Virginia possum there on the bottom. And yet you have things where they claim that a kangaroo in Australia evolved into a wolf that looks just like an American wolf. If you gave the untrained person the skull of this kangaroo wolf and a gray wolf from North America, and if you were not an expert, you couldn't tell the difference between these skulls, right? And their claim is obviously that these two unrelated species, through natural selection and mutations, turn out to be exactly identical. Unbelievable. Absolutely unbelievable. This one's even more incredible, obviously. Here in the Ice Age, we had the saber-toothed tiger here in California. We get ones in the La Brea tar pits, and yet they claim a kangaroo in Australia, through natural selection and mutations, became a saber-toothed tiger with a pouch just like a kangaroo in Australia. Unbelievable. We still can't figure out why in the world these animals had these large teeth. The saber-toothed tiger and this kangaroo saber-toothed tiger, these teeth were very big, but they're very fragile. Matter of fact, they can't even understand how these animals lived, right? Because if you tried to kill, a buffalo or something like that with these teeth, they'd probably break off. And so this animal obviously doesn't fit even in the evolutionary tree because these teeth are not beneficial. Wings appear independently in lots of different species. This one I like, obviously. I call this nature is out to get you. Humans did not invent hypodermic needles until the Civil War, and yet we have hypodermic needles, a solid tube giving out a venom appearing all the way in plants and all different type of animals. And they claim that just random mutations produce these hypodermic needles with poison in all these different species that are totally unrelated. Unbelievable. An octopus claim that an octopus evolved from a clam. I have a hard time believing that. And then not only did the octopus go from a clam to an octopus, then it also has a human eye. And yet its eye is actually even better than ours. Our eye has a little blind spot in the back of it where the optic nerve is, and the octopus eye looks exactly like a human eye, but it doesn't have the blind spot. So an octopus has a little bit better vision than we do. And the claim is obviously, again, these are just totally random mutations and natural selection that produce identical eyes. Right. Echolocation, they claim, appeared totally unrelated species. Sand lance and a chameleon both have independent eyes that rotate in sockets. Prickly hair appears in totally unrelated species. Anteaters, three unrelated animals that have long, sticky tongues and strong claws. This one grows every year because people that believe evolution is true, they claim obviously that they're gonna find a junk in the evolutionary tree, stuff that comes up that's totally useless. And the problem with that view obviously then is rather than looking at an animal and looking for a purpose and design, the scientists have initially gone back and said, this is useless junk. And they just stopped studying it. And then 10, 20 years later, they find out it's not junk, it's perfectly designed. And this has been very detrimental. For years, they were yanking out appendices and tonsils, thinking, oh, they're just useless junk, taking out people's vital immune systems, right? And so anybody that comes up to me and says, well, science only believes in science and facts, you know, and evidence, and you're religious, you know, and you believe just in faith. I put this stuff to them and I say, science is not based on, is truly evidence and facts, obviously, because you get this stuff wrong and then you won't even admit that you were wrong. You had to rewrite your textbook. You know, the Bible, I can't change it. If there's something, quote unquote, wrong in the Bible, I can't rewrite it. Whereas science books, when they make an error, you know, a big error for 100 years, you know, they just rewrite the book and pretend like, oh, no, we didn't believe that. So in reality, all this stuff is thing. The last time I taught this class, one of the guys at the end rose his hand, we'll get questions really soon here, and said, well, I still believe in evolution because of whale hips. And I told him, I said, if it turns out that whale hips are not junk for leftover from evolution but are perfectly designed, would you change your opinion? And he refused to answer the question. I hope he's listening today online, because guess what? Whale hips are perfectly designed to hold the reproductive organs of whales. If that hip bone wasn't there, and the leftover little leg bones they claim weren't there, the whales wouldn't be able to reproduce. Those bones are perfectly designed and have perfect shape for these animals to reproduce. And for decades, scientists claim there was proof for evolution, right? And they got it wrong again. They get it wrong all the time. Anytime they say this is useless junk, they get it wrong. The only two that I could find, obviously, there are some beetles that have wings under their sheath that don't use them for flying. And if you look at a kiwi wing, it's so small, it's pretty tough to see how that's got any design purpose. So I could only find two. Where that's there, and most of the things obviously turned out that they get it wrong. Good, we're getting to humans. We're going to end with humans, obviously. Hugh and Fuzz have a great book. Hugh is Adam, and so we're going to start looking at humans, and that will be the last slides that we have. Looking at DNA mutations, originally they thought that the human population came from a large population of animals, species, and now obviously looking at DNA testing, the evidence comes back that the humans came from such a small population that they call it mitochondrial Eve. And so it dates back, they used to have an exact date and they realized they put errors in their assumptions. So somewhere between 100,000 and 200,000 years ago, the human population could be dated back to one woman. And so this is scientists. Scientists call this mitochondrial Eve because the evidence points to one woman so much. So even these people that don't believe in the Bible are using Bible terminology because the evidence so strongly points to the human population coming back to one woman. Likewise, when we look at the Y chromosome of males, that also dates back to about 100,000 years plus or minus, 100,000, or 100,000 to 200,000 years. And so the evidence for men's DNA also goes back to being one person, not a large population. A lot of times you'll hear scientists say out of Africa, because there's more DNA variety in Africa, the claim is that humans originate in Africa. And I don't know whether it's ignorance or whether it's bias, but every one of these articles that I read about out of Africa, they always show a current map of Africa and claim that this is where humans started. You cannot use the map of today to talk about something that happened 100,000 years ago. 100,000 years ago, Africa did not look like it does today. There was no Red Sea. There was no Persian Gulf. Those were dry. And so the Middle East, Mesopotamia, where Bible says humans started, was part of Africa. So you'll hear, if you listen to Hugh or anybody in Reasons to Believe, they'll use this out of Africa and Mesopotamia interchangeable, because the out of Africa does not contradict the Bible at all. Because if you use the map from 100,000 years ago, they were the same continent. We study language, and study of languages prove that all languages date back to about 150,000 years ago, matches the DNA date, right? So all languages came from one original language, again proving that the population, humans came from one single place and one single population. And this is our last topic, and then we'll go to questions. When Neanderthals were discovered, it was claimed that this was a missing link between humans and, and, and apes, right, you know? We've now know that it's not a missing link. As a matter of fact, I was talking to Hugh about this, and Hugh said, because they can't find the missing link between humans and apes, they just deleted the word from every textbook. Right? It's one way to ruin it. Wouldn't it be great in your life if you had a problem and all you do is just never talk about it, never write about it, and pretend it doesn't exist? And that's exactly what the scientists have done. Because there is no missing link, and because the fossil record has the brain sizes getting big and small and big and sile, and instead of a tree, right? So you have this problem where the fossil record doesn't support your theory, you just get rid of the word missing link, right? We know now, obviously, Neanderthals can't be in the chain because they're just too radically different than humans, right? They appear, they remain unchanged for their entire time on Earth. They have large skulls, large brow, huge jaw, large nasal capacity, 10 times of ours. The youth develop like apes, not like humans. Very thick bones, huge barrel chest with large lung capacity. No tear ducts, they can't cry, right? Right, so anybody calls a human a Neanderthal, I just say, well, can they cry? Well, that proves they're not a Neanderthal. Short limbs, large brow, no evidence of clothing. These people are animals. It's not a missing link. It's a bipedal primate animal. And so a lot of times they'll say now it's just an independent offshoot. It's a dead end in the evolutionary tree. Well, I got news. Every single species is a dead end in the evolutionary tree. Every single one of them. All right. This is interesting. Darwin obviously made the prediction that since he believed in this gradual evolution, his prediction 100 years ago, more than 100 years ago, was that humans should be just one step above the other primates because we're just animals that evolved. And Hugh said it's amazing that it took like 100 years for people to actually test that theory, right? So Darwin made this prediction that humans are just going to be a little bit higher than animals, and people didn't test it. And within the last 10 and 20 years, people have started to look at humans versus the animals to see, are we different? And every single year, there's more evidence to prove of human exceptionalism, that we are not just one step above the animal. We're a skyscraper, you know, compared to a one-story building when you compare us to animals. And so I don't have time to go all of this. We're the only species that can do symbolic representation, be able to manipulate symbols, invent and manufacture complex tools. I mean, animals can do simple tools. That's another failure of the biology, anthropology. The claim originally when I went to school, the definition of humans was tool makers. But it turned out there's animals that make tools. So they got it wrong. They had to rewrite the textbook. Explosive technology, manufacturing clothes, invent things, complex social structures, transportation, mathematics, that's a huge one. We have in our brain, we have this large section that's used for complex math, and that's been there ever since humans evolved, right? So when humans first appeared, we had that section to do complex math, even though we had invented math. And so there's no naturalist thing. Why would our brain develop this huge section for math, and we have to wait thousands of years for calculus to be invented to use it? There's no evolutionary gain to have, you know, this complex math. We're the only species to do math, literature, philosophy, theology, only ones to tame animals and train them. Some animals in the wild are attracted to us and attached to us. They don't attach to other animals. That includes whales, right? I have a friend that was out kayaking, and a whale came up and said hi to him, went back and got its baby and brought it up to him. Why in the world would a huge species in the ocean be attracted to humans, right? There's no evolution for that. You know, if God created these animals to please us, that completely explains it. Large skull with the spiritual lobe. Animals aren't capable of worship because their brain literally doesn't have the hardware. Hand dexterity better than anybody else. Long lifespans. Long infant and adolescent development, right? So parent moms know this, right? You know. We say that you're an adult at 18, but we know now that the human brain doesn't fully develop until 25. Other species, nothing like that. You know, within a few years, the animal's fully developed. Humans are unlike that. Long lifespan with a high metabolic rate. Tall, slender bodies, very no fur. We're designed to do heat and cold with clothes. And of course, the only animal to have religious activity, prayer, think about death and the afterlife. All right, we'll open it up to questions. Questions can be any topic. You can talk about this, but I'm, like I said, I've been a member of the class and follower of Hugh for 40 years, so I'm pretty covered on every question you may want to ask.
It is in 2 weeks, so sorry. Hugh Ross will be here next weekend, 7 days from now. The weekend after that will be closed. If you have questions, you can go to paradoxes.org and put it there, or you can write it down, or you can come back to the mic here and give your questions. We do have a few online questions, Dave. And Dave, what's this on the table back here? Mike.
And fossils, rocks and fossils.
Rocks and fossils.
I have petrified trunk of a tree, petrified bark, and also a fish that is 60 million years old. And then I also just brought some rocks. Marble is very interesting. I have a section of marble back there. Marble is ancient coral that's turned into a rock. So that's very interesting too. Go ahead.
Hi, this is my question. Nowadays, you know, if siblings have kids, they are going to have genetic issues.
They have issues, I'm sorry?
If siblings, sister and brothers, if they get married and they have kids,
yeah,
their kids are going to have genetic issues, right? Or
yes,
bad mutations.
Correct.
So what is the explanation for the first humans, how they reproduce?
Yeah, the Bible actually answers that. Moses gave the law about 3,500 years ago and declared that brothers and sisters could no longer get married. And so the Bible says before that, so before 3,500 years ago, the Bible did not forbid brothers and sisters from marrying. And that's because, obviously, we just talked about mutations. And so the number of mutations actually increases. So not only are we discovering new mutations, right? So I said there's a 2,000 detrimental mutations that we have recorded on humans. And so that 1,200 increase in the last 10 years is two ones. One, we found new mutations, right, that were there, we just didn't discover. And some of those are brand new mutations, right? So the human population is heading towards extinction. I talk about every species is heading towards extinction because mutations increase. Right, so there's radiation, there's pollution. You know, in the human population, we talk about drugs and alcohol. So we have even more negative mutations than animals because animals aren't doing drugs and, you know, and smoking and things like that and having an unhealthy lifestyle. Before that prohibition 3,500 years ago, there was less mutations in the DNA. So a brother and sister getting married, their children actually would be healthy. But because mutations have increased as humans have gone along, at 3,500 years ago, God told Moses through Revelation, you know, brothers and sisters can't get married anymore because their children would be very sick. And at that same time, obviously, you know, we actually had the evidence because the pharaohs were marrying their sisters and their children becoming very unhealthy. So we have it both from the Bible and then from the pharaohs, we have evidence that became true. So previous to that, brothers and sisters getting married, having children, there weren't problems. But because mutations have increased, God finally sat there and said, brothers and sisters can't get married anymore. It's a good question.
Okay, Dave. Are you ready for a wordy question on multiverse and origin of life?
Always.
Okay, here goes. Tenny W. is to Dr. Ross. But famous atheist podcaster Alex O'Connor had scientist Brian Greene on a show talking about fine-tuning. Brian Greene's argument against divine design is that he believes that in a multiverse universe with physical constants close to ours, there will not have life. But if they are radically different, they might lead to a new local maximum, like a multivariant calculus. But did I lose you yet, Dave? There's still more. Okay.
Go ahead.
In a multiverse universe with physical constants leading to a patchwork of universes that support life. This seems far-fetched to me, but what are good apologetics counter-arguments for that?
Yeah. So that claim, you know, 10, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, there would be no arguments against that. It would be viable. So again, science increases. And so when people say things like that, they're quoting stuff that's 20, 30 years old. And what we have discovered, obviously, is if you go back 10, 20 years ago, the claim was that you could have life based on silicon, you could have based on boron, you know, there were other things in the periodic table that we could say we had life on. In the last 20 or 30 years now, we've discovered that life has to be carbon based. No other element in the periodic table can produce life. And that's because carbon is the only element that can bond together in very complex ways and make very complex molecules. And so silicon is just not complex enough to produce the things we need for life. Boron is not complex. No other element in the periodic table can produce the very complex amino acids and proteins that we need for life. And so life must be carbon-based. The next thing, obviously, when we look at this universe, you know, I don't have the book up here, I have it over there, in Design to the Core and Improbable Planet, Hugh outlines in very detailed facts that if you change any parameter of the universe, the size, the age, the weak nuclear force, the strong nuclear force, gravity, first law of thermodynamics, second law of thermodynamics, all that's seven laws. If you change those, even 0.01%, you have no life anywhere in the universe, you know, for the whole history of the universe. And so life has to be the way that it is, and the universe has to be the way it is. So if the claim, obviously, if there's some other universe, you know, it could have some other laws of physics and produce some other type of life, you know, then you're obviously no longer dealing with physical reality. You're in metaphysics. And so when all these scientists talk about the multiverse, they have left science, right? And the reason, obviously, is Einstein proved that any being that's in the three-dimensional space and the one-dimensional time that we're in can never detect another dimension of space and time. And so these scientists that talk about multiverses, they have left science. They have left this universe, and they have gone into the world of religion and metaphysics, right? It's pure speculation, right? You know, because there's no evidence for it. Hugh doesn't use it as often, but he uses it as the gambler's fallacy. Correct, thank you. That if I flip a coin 10, 20 times and it always comes up head, you know, a multiverse person can say, well, of course your coin came up 20 times head because there are an unlimited number of Daves in a number of unlimited universes, and they're flipping coins, and their coins coming up different. So the odds of mine coming up, you know, heads, you know, 20 times is reasonable, you know. And so I would ask the person that believes in the multiverse, I said, well, let's bet, you know, $2,000 that I flip the coin that it's going to come up heads, right? Because there's all these other Days in other universes. Well, nobody that believes in the universe in multiverses would bet the coin's going to come up head, you know, another 3-4 times, right? You know, because there's no evidence for these other people flipping coins. And so it's a gambler's fallacy. More likely, if my coin is always coming up heads, more likely there's two possibilities. Either I have a two-headed coin, or the coin is some way designed, you know, to always come up heads, right? Design, right? And that's what we see in this universe. We see design. And it doesn't matter whether you look at the whole size of the universe. If you took out one dime of mass of the universe, one dime, you have no possibility of life anywhere in the universe at any time in the universe. If you increase the size of the mass of the universe, then all you have is black holes. If you decrease the mass of the universe by a dime, then you never have heavy elements to produce iron that you need in your blood, right? So the universe must be exactly the way it is, the size it is, the age it is, the temperature it is, the entropy that it is. You know, you can't change anything about the universe. You can't change anything about the atom. You will have no life anywhere. And life must be carbon-based. So these claims about different type of life in different universes, it doesn't match physical reality. Okay, what?
Okay. Robert Gibson asked, does the RTB creation model support symbiosis of microbes, plants, and animals as many creation models as many creation events, Asa or Bara, at that origin of life form and why. Did you catch that, or you want me to read it one more time?
Read it one more time.
Okay. Does the RTB creation model support symbiosis of microbes, plants, and animals as many creation models at that origin of life form?
So, very good question, obviously. So, yeah, symbiotic relationships is a big problem for evolution and for origin of life. And so the prediction, again, I talked about was that when life form first appears, it's going to be simple, and it's only going to be one species. In reality, we find out, obviously, that through looking at the fossil record and the evidence, chemical evidence for life. So we have two things for the origin of life. We have the actual fossils. We actually have the fossils of this blue-green algae, this cyanobacteria. So we actually have fossil evidence that going back millions of years that shows that the first life forms were very complex, cyanobacteria, which is it's photosynthetic bacteria. So it's very, very complex, right? And then the next one, obviously, then is the symbiotic relationship. In order for that bacteria to survive, it actually has to be in a colony with other species. And so we rapidly see, obviously, other species arrive. So one of the next things that winds up appearing is sulfate-reducing bacteria. And that is really important to be on the planet of the Earth for millions of years in order to make things soluble. So we need solid iron. We can't have it just in the water. So there's lots of chemicals that we have for both our body and we use for our technology that these millions of years of sulfate-reducing bacteria use. The second thing we find out now is that if you only had bacteria, then what could happen is that bacteria could increase too numerous, right, for its environment and then go extinct. So in order to maintain bacteria for billions of years, you actually have to have specially designed bacteria to keep the population in control. So we always think of bacteria as being bad, and every year now we find out that bacteria is actually perfectly designed to maintain life over planet Earth over a long period of time. You know, so Hugh always jokes in their family that sometimes they actually will thank God for bacteria, you know, in their prayers. Because if we didn't have these bacteria, obviously, in the early part of the Earth, that bacteria wouldn't have survived and it wouldn't have been able to produce the oxygen that we have. Most of our oxygen comes from the ocean, from cyanobacteria, not trees. So this bacteria produced the oxygen that you breathe, billions of years of oxygen. And these bacteria, obviously, had kept these species in check. Another thing we found out just recently, obviously, is we always thought that dust was the source of seeding clouds. It turns out that bacteria and the parts of bacteria is very critical in cloud formation. So if we didn't have these billions, trillions of bacteria on planet Earth, we wouldn't have as much rain. So the next time you see rain, thank God for viruses, right? The specifically to his question, we have a lot of species that won't survive unless the other one is there. So the two have to come together. The one I like, lichen. Lichen is actually a bacteria and a fungus. And the two have to come together. And they have to be the same species in order to produce the particular lichen. And there's multiple types of lichen. So the question always comes up, what came first? The algae, obviously, or the fungus, right? If you take away one, if they don't appear at the same time, you don't get the species. We have ants, obviously, that have the same thing, obviously. The ant appears, and this ant needs a bacteria or a fungus to do. And it can't be just any fungus. It has to be that particular fungus. So which came first, the ant or the fungus, right? The two of them have to be there at the same time. If the ant's not there, the fungus wouldn't survive because the ant has to feed the fungus. If the fungus arrives, there's no ant to feed it. And so we have lots of these. And we've actually found some of them where there's three species that have to appear, right? What's the odds of three species all appearing exactly at the same time to support one another? In more than a theory, that obviously shows a design, and it doesn't show random mutations. Go ahead.
Hi. I hear people say that people of European and Asian ancestry have like 2 or 3 or 4% Neanderthal DNA, whereas maybe people of sub-Saharan African ancestry don't have any. I was wondering what you make of that.
Yeah, so some people claim, obviously, that that's proof that Neanderthals mated with humans, obviously, and that's what the people that believe in evolution think is true, and that's because Neanderthals and humans overlap for a few thousand years in Europe. For me, I think it's completely bogus, obviously. When we look at humans, I have not found a single person with short arms. I've not found a single person with, large bones. I've never found a single person with a huge naval capacity. I've not found a single person that's not capable of crying. I found it sound a single person with these big, huge brows that you see on this skull. We just don't see anything that looks like Neanderthals. So all these things here, so if humans actually had mated with Neanderthals, there should have been a recessive gene, and if that recessive gene is real, obviously, then some of these things should appear. And the mere fact that none of these appear in the genome proves that what happens, obviously, is that you just have a short segment of DNA that happens to match a Neanderthal. And if that's proof of mating, then I mated with yeast. 60% of my body is exactly, DNA is exactly the same as a yeast. So maybe somewhere in my family tree, my ancestors mated with yeast somehow, 60% of my DNA matches daffodils. Maybe somewhere in my family tree, they were eating daffodils and having sex with daffodils. And so this claim, that the claim is obviously that if some DNA here matches some DNA here, that there's some close relationship, is just totally bogus. The DNA tree just doesn't support that. And so a very small change in DNA can produce huge results, right? So a lot of times people will tell me the fact that obviously that 90, that used to be saying 98, it's actually lower than that. Obviously now that we've done the complete sequencing of DNA in humans, the percentages left. But for years the claim was that 98% of my DNA matches a chimpanzee. And they say that's proof of evolution. And then I come back there and say, well, a cloud is 100% water, and a watermelon is 90% watermelon, right? So maybe clouds came from watermelons, right? It's only 1%. That's less than the chimp and the human. So 1% change can make a huge difference. And what's the difference between a cloud and a watermelon? Is that 1% is obviously information, right? It's just a little bit of iron, a little bit of phosphor, a lot of enuric acid, obviously, in the DNA. So just 1% of information can turn, 90%, 99% water into a watermelon that's delicious, right? And so the watermelon's got these carbs, these sugars in it, and it was produced by just 1% information. And so this percentage game, of Neanderthals or humans and chimps, it's childish, obviously. Because again, 90% of my DNA matches a yeast. And why? Because obviously most of the information in your DNA is to make a cell work. I don't have the book here, but Fuzz has a book called The Cell's Design. And as we've studied cells, we find out now that they're intricate factories. You just talked about that recently. We actually see pistons engines, rotary engines, gates and valves, literally like a whole factory in there. And so most of our DNA is making that cell work. And so just a little teeny change in our DNA can produce huge differences, right? And so this percentage game is ridiculous, and this Neanderthal comparison, in my opinion, is ridiculous.
Valerie asked a question about hybrid vigor. Is it real, and does it help animals? And hybrid vigor.
I still don't understand.
Hybrid vigor. You know what that is?
Hybrid what?
Hybrid, like a hybrid.
Oh, hybrid. Okay, yes, hybrid, yes.
Hybrid vigor. Is it real, and does it help animals and humans even?
Hybrid, what's the second word?
Vigor. Vigor, V-I-G-O-R. I think you haven't heard of it, Dave. It's when you cross two different species together.
Like
the mule thing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Hugh talks about that all. Some animals, obviously, their DNA is close enough that you can mate and produce hybrids, obviously. Hugh actually uses that as a proof that evolution is not true. I actually deleted this slide just to keep my show simpler. I used to have a slide here on zonkies and ligers. And so everybody knows if you cross a donkey and a zebra, you can get a zonkie, a half animal and stuff. And so that proves that obviously that their DNA is similar enough We have a horse and a donkey will get you a mule, right? The mule is sterile, a zonkey is sterile, and so you can obviously have animals where their DNA is close enough that you get an offspring, but then that offspring can't produce a baby. And then Hugh uses the donkey and the zebra because obviously if they're so close in DNA, then the two animals should be similar, right? And yet a zebra and a donkey's behavior, you couldn't get more different. If you domesticate, they have instances where somebody domesticated a donkey and had it for, say, you know, 5 or 6 years, and it bonded to the human. We have instances where the donkey got lost for 10, 20 years. And 10 or 20 years later, the owner found the donkey. The donkey would be just as bonded to that human like he was before he got lost. They're just very loyal animals, very tamed. If you tame a zebra, if you go one day without petting and spending an hour with that zebra, you could come the next day and that animal would be wild and try and kill you, right? And yet these two animals can breed. So Hugh will ask the biologist, how can you have two animals that are so, their DNA is so close that they can reproduce? How can they have such different personalities? How could one be so tameable and the other one so untamable, you know? And so these things, there's multiple animals that can do that. It was very interesting for the liger. And so a zoo put a tiger and a lion together because it assumed that the two couldn't mate. Biologists said their DNA is different. The length of their DNA is different. They can't mate. Well, lo and behold, the lion got pregnant and produced a liger, right? And they're like, well, okay, well, it was a freak thing, you know? So maybe Jurassic Park was right. Life found a way, right? I mean, they are both cats, and so they produced it. So then they left the liger in the cage, and they said, well, it has to be like a mule, and it can't reproduce, right? Well, guess what? The liger mated with a male lion and produced again. And so it turns out that lions and tigers are closer in species than they thought, obviously. And once again, obviously, these animals could mate, so you'd think that a lion and a tiger must be very similar, right? No. Lions live in prides and are very loyal animals. We have the same thing with people that raise baby lions, and then they taught them to be wild animals, put them in the wild. That human came back 10 years later, and not only did that lion come up and lick the person as if it was like yesterday, it actually then went and told the pride that this person's part of our pride, and the whole pride of wild animals came up and licked this human and treated it like it was part of the pride. So lions are actually probably more loyal than dogs, right? If you have a dog and you lose it for 5, 10 years, there's no guarantee that it will bond to you. But every single lion, obviously, that bonds to a human, it doesn't matter what time changes, that lion is so loyal that it would not eat that human. It would protect it and treat it like it was part of its pride. Now, if you go to a tiger, tigers are solitary animals. They don't live in prides, right? You know, and if you have a pet tiger and if you lose it for 10 years, you better hope you never see it in the wild because it will kill and eat you, right? So again, obviously, these animals that are closely related prove that evolution isn't true, right? So just because the DNA is the same doesn't mean they're the same animals, right? They're totally different animals. Okay, go ahead. Probably last question.
This will be the last question, Dave.
There you go.
Hi. What are your thoughts on the Nephilim? The Nephilim, remember how in Genesis 5?
I'll try and do a quick one on that. Hugh has a whole chapter in his book, Navigating Genesis. And if you go online to Reasons to Believe / Hugh Ross, he actually gives that chapter away free. So anybody that would like more information on that, you don't even have to buy the book. You can just go online, Reasons to Believe / Hugh Ross, is it Hugh Ross or just Ross? No, Hugh Ross. And he has a free chapter on this book. You can just search for that, for Navigating Genesis free chapter. Reasons to Believe view on that, obviously, is that the Bible talks about fallen angels coming to earth having relationships with females and producing these large beings. And the mere fact that their size defies gravity proves that obviously they're not totally physical, that they are some type of combination of physical and spiritual being. And that fits with the rest of the Bible. The Bible says that you have entertained angels unaware, right? And so angels can appear as a donkey. They can appear as an angel of light. They can come as a giant. right? So angels obviously are able to take on physical form. They only do that for a brief period of time. My evidence, obviously, I don't know if I probably have talked to angels, but I'm unaware of it. I have a very close friend, and so I completely believe this story because he was there. He and his wife experienced this, that his teenage son was in a car accident and was near death. And the accident happened in the middle of the night, of course, you know, a teenager driving his car in the middle of the night. So they were there while the son was in surgery and very worried that he would die. They went to the basement of the hospital because they said they had a coffee vending machine there in a room that they usually have with tables and chairs. They went in there and bought some coffee and some snacks or whatever. And in the room was somebody that looked like a homeless person. And he looked at him and said, "Your son will be okay." And they were just flabbergasted. They were like, well, you know, they felt like, well, how you know, they were, first it was like, how do you know? But obviously they didn't answer that question. But the guy just went on to assure them, obviously, that their son would live and that he would recover and that he would be okay. And it was very comforting, but yet it was a very strange experience. The room only had one door. They walked out the door, took two steps down the aisleway, and then thought, that was really strange. I mean, who is this guy? How does he know our son? So they turned around two steps and walked into the room. Room was empty, right? So that's the closest one I know of, a personal friend that met an angel that appeared as a human in tattered clothes and offered words of comfort, right? So there's other stories like that. So the Nephilim don't bother me, obviously, because there are spiritual beings. They can form any things. I really appreciate it. The last episode of the Amazon series House of David was aired. They presented the Nephilim very well in that one. The same thing, the mother of one of these giants, you know, told the story, obviously, that she met, you know, a fallen angel and had given birth to him, obviously. You know, they add a lot to it. They have a little thing, the disclaimer, the bob for the very front, you know, they have to add stuff to fill it up to make the whole series, right? So there's a 4 or 5 week series, obviously. But they did their very good job in being very biblical based on that, and added a few things. If you haven't seen it, it's worth seeing. Greg Laurie has been using it as an outreach tool to talk about the Bible because it ends obviously with David declaring, you know that God is with Israel, and that's the reason Israel was preserved, right? So Israel has had people that have tried to wipe it off the face of the earth ever since they came into existence, right? So it's not just the Arabs today. You know, before that we had Egypt, you know, that totally captured them and took every single one into captivity, into Babylon, obviously into captivity. And so there's been many of nations that have tried to wipe out the Jews, including, you know, Hitler. And God has protected this little tribe. And there were lots of tribes in Israel. Josh, just even in the sermon today, was talking about, obviously, God choosing Israel because he loved them, not because it was most powerful or good or anything, you know. The word chosen in the Bible, obviously, is just like God went into an orphanage of nations, these lots of nations there and little tribes, and just picked one, right? And so the other tribes that were around Israel, they're all gone. How did Israel survive, obviously? It's supernatural that God protected these people and helped them in their battles, and history proves that.
All set, Dave?
That's it.
Thank you so much. And would you please close us in prayer?
Thank you. Lord Jesus, we know that you knock on the heart of every single person that's ever lived. No one, when they get into the gates and judgment day, can say, I didn't know. We're so thankful that your light has gone out into the world. We're so thankful, Jesus, that you knock on the hearts of every single person. We're so thankful that in Romans it declares, and in Psalms it declares, that nature itself declares your glory and your majesty. We thank you for all these plants and animals that you have made, that we're able to study them and to admire them. We thank you for animals that are attracted to us, you know, not only our pets, our cats and our dogs, but wild animals like whales that want to come up to us. It's just proof, obviously, that you created these animals to please and to serve us. We pray that people would protect them, obviously. We pray, obviously, that the people that are Protecting animals from poachers, obviously, would protect them and help them preserve these wonderful species and animals that you put on this planet. We're so thankful that all these animals declare your righteousness and your glory. We're so thankful that these animals are there to teach us. May we